Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision Radio Show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Welcome to the Age of Vision Radio Show. My name is Lonnie Clark.
I have the great honor of interviewing
Drew Kuhn, who is on the line with us, is with the Missouri Accountability Project. And I'm going to let him discuss what the goals are, and he will be updating us as to the progress being made in St. Louis to get the Army Corps of Engineers to take over the remediation of nuclear contamination from World War II, that's at the Westlake landfill and near a fire from the EPA, who has summarily bungled it. So welcome, Drew, to the Age of Vision Radio Show. I really appreciate you being here.
Hi, Lonnie. Thank you for having me, and thanks to your listeners for tuning in.
Yeah, well, we really do need... Why don't you update our listeners, kind of give an overview for those people who are just hearing us for the first time. What's happening in St. Louis?
What's happening in St. Louis?
Yeah, what is the contamination all about? Explain what happened.
We've had nuclear legacy waste here since the Manhattan Project in 1950s, when Mallinckrodt was contracted by the federal government to purify uranium. I have a brief little timeline here, actually. It's pretty concise and short. 1942, Mallinckrodt Chemical Works begins processing uranium for a top-secret Manhattan Project in St. Louis by the Manhattan Engineering District. In 1945, atomic bombs are dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, with uranium processed and purified by the MED. A side note on that, Japan was already negotiating their surrender in Moscow when we decided to drop the bombs. It was advised against by a large panel of scientists. In 1946, a 22-acre site near the St. Louis Airport, SLAPS, is used to store nuclear residues and waste. Eventually, more than 125,000 tons of waste and residues are stored there in rusting barrels and piles out in the open.
Can you say that again? 1926?
Yeah. 1946, 22-acre site near St. Louis Airport, we call it SLAPS, is used to store nuclear residues and waste. Eventually, more than 125,000 tons of waste and residue are stored in rusting barrels and piles out in the open.
Wow.
It was that waste that contaminated Coldwater Creek, which, for those unfamiliar with the geography, runs straight into the Mississippi River.
Oh, my gosh.
In 1962, Continental Mining and Milling Company of Chicago purchases an entire contents of the SLAP site from the Atomic Energy Commission. AEC instructs to bidders that all nuclear waste must go from the airport site. In 1969, nuclear waste is passed along to various other possible, quote, responsible parties and dumped at Laddie Avenue in Hazelwood, Missouri. That's my hometown.
Wow.
In 1973, Cotter Corp. buys nuclear waste from Laddie Avenue and mixes 8,700 tons of leached barium sulfate with contaminated soil and illegally dumps it at Westlake Landfill in Bridgeton, Missouri. The total amount is between 43,000 and 48,000 tons. In 2010, on December 23rd, a subsurface smoldering event, fancy word for a fire, was reported at the Bridgeton Sanitary Landfill. To this day, the event continues. Now, this particular fire that was reported in 2010 is not the first of its kind. The first reported fire that was known by the EPA was first reported in 1992, and that was in the north quarry of the landfill near radioactive waste. The EPA at the time deemed it not hazardous to public health and safety, so the fire was allowed to burn. They kind of pop up in pockets. So this more recent fire in 2010 is in the south quarry of the Bridgeton landfill, and again, to this day, continues to burn. Recent DNR reports from the fourth quarter of 2015, December, shows that temperatures have elevated slightly but gradually north of the neck between the two landfills. There's two landfills here. There's Bridgeton, which is burning and not adequately characterized for radioactive contamination. And then to the north of that is Westlake Landfill. And these two quarries are separated by a neck. And in that neck, there's been a constructed cooling loop, some different engineered designs to try to reduce the temperatures. And, again, as of December of 2015...
Do you mind if I stop and ask you what that means? I mean, you're using some sort of technical words. At least it sounds technical to me, so I'm going to ask you. Because
sure.
I can't quite... You're saying it's... There's a neck, so there's geographically, when we look at the map, we can see the two sites, the Westlake Landfill and what else? Tell me
that.
And
the Bridgeton Landfill.
Okay, and in between them, you said there's a neck. What does that mean, like a canal or something?
Yeah, a canal of sorts. Yeah, you can think of it like that.
Okay, okay.
And it's cut between the two landfills.
Okay, so there's some distance between them, but the fire, or what they call a subsurface smoldering event, which, because is it actually a fire, or is it just like it's a chemical reaction that's excessively hot?
A fire is a chemical reaction. It requires three things. It requires oxygen, heat, and a fuel source. It has all three of those things, and it's a chemical reaction. The temperatures vary. So that's usually where Republic Services likes to split hairs and call it a subsurface smoldering reaction, as opposed to a fire, which is, I guess, more inflammatory language. But for all intents and purposes, what's happening in Bridgeton Landfill is a fire, an underground fire.
Wow. Okay, so that is ongoing, and from what I understand, that fire is less than 1,000 feet away from the Westlake Landfill?
The fire, the front of the fire is approximately 1,000 feet from the closest known sampled test site for radioactive waste, meaning they drilled a hole, they said, yes, this area right here is contaminated by waste, and that's the, provided by data from the DNR.
Wow. So, okay, so that clarifies some things for me. So this nuclear waste is kind of in that same landfill, in other words. It's all one big, gigantic landfill. It's just 1,000 feet away from it. It's just 1,000 feet away from where they know the radiation is actually known area of radiation.
Right.
Wow.
I would say the biggest difference between the two landfills is just the regulatory oversight, who oversees them, with the Westlake. Is overseen by EPA and is a Superfund site, and Bridgeton Landfill is overseen by Missouri Department of Natural Resources, which is a state agency. You stated earlier in the program, our U.S. Senate recently voted 2,600 to transfer the cleanup efforts of Westlake Landfill over to the Army Corps of Engineers FUSRAP, which is formerly utilized Sites Remedial Action Program. They have a great track record since the 1990s. They have shipped by rail from Missouri to a proper containment facility in Colorado over 1 million cubic yards of contaminated waste without incident, contrary to what Republic Services would like you to believe, that that it would be devastating for the whole state. They have done a very great job of this. So we as a community have felt for years that this a project of this magnitude would be better suited for the Army Corps.
Go ahead. Complete your thoughts.
Well, it still has to pass through the House. It's in committee, I believe, until February
10th. February 10th is when the next committee meeting is. And it will not go on, but this is a live show. So anybody listening to this could actually contact the House of Representatives. It's in the Environment and Waste. What's the name of the committee that it's in, Drew? Do you know?
I believe the committees are...
I had to look it up. I don't remember. I called the committee the other day because my congressman, Pete DeFazio, is actually a member on that committee. So I called his office and said, hey, isn't it called the Environment and Public Works?
Yeah, I believe it's Environment and Public Works and Transportation is one of them also.
Right, it's in the Transportation Committee. It's a subcommittee. So you kind of have to do... I apologize. I did not have the phone number on me, but people can call up and look that up on the website on the House of the Congress. And the title of the bill is HB 4100. Is that correct, or is it 2500?
Yes, that is correct.
4100. So you can type in, go to US.gov and look up in the Congress, and HB 4100, and look and see where it says on committee. You can click on the link and it'll give you the phone numbers, and you can see the committee members and see if one of your elected officials is a committee member. There's about 13 or 14 people there. So we can put a lot of pressure on them to, you know, get this out of committee immediately and get this voted on, and then we come into the second part of the project, right, which is getting the funding for this to happen. It's one thing to move it from the Army Corps of Engineers, to the Army Corps of Engineers from the EPA, but how long do you think it would take us to get the funding? I mean, has anybody talked to you about that, Drew?
I do not have an exact number on that, so I'd rather not speak.
My understanding is that it's going to be part of the budget process that comes down.
Right, fiscal year budget that's passed will provide funding to the Army Corps. I know that Westlake Landfill wasn't apportioned in the last fiscal year for the Army Corps Food Drive.
Mm-hmm.
So we may be looking at next year.
So, Drew, let me just backtrack a little bit here. We came on live on this air because I had attempted to record a session, and it didn't quite work, so I had to start over. And I opted to go live because that seemed to make it work the best, and evidently it is. So, but when you said we talked about this earlier, we actually hadn't. That was on the 15-minute session that we ditched. It didn't work. But we were talking, and I do want to introduce Drew Kuhn a little bit more properly because he's with the Missouri Accountability Project. Drew and I have spoken before. He is actually quite young. You might hear that in his voice, but he's a young man. He's a citizen of Missouri who has been affected by this and has been actively engaged, I believe you told me, since you were 17 years old, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and so why don't you explain what the goals are for the Missouri Accountability Project?
I'd love to. Thank you. Well, our mission is to seek to empower citizens to effectively engage government agencies as advocates for the protection of the environment. Presently, our goals are to urge responsible parties of Bridgeton Landfill to adequately characterize radiation so as to expedite an effective isolation barrier while further researching landfill fire remediation technology. We also petitioned Governor Nixon to facilitate interagency emergency risk planning and evacuation by declaring a state of emergency. We request that Congress transfer jurisdiction of Westlake Landfill remediation to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers with the aid of formerly utilized sites remedial action program. So
cut
and dry, that's pretty much it.
Well, it looks like the third one's in process, right? The third one sure is in process. I mean, we really do need to move. This is the thing that really does shock me. You know, I report regularly on my radio show about nuclear pollution. I became aware of this when, frankly, Fukushima, not even right when Fukushima happened, I believed the government story for about a year and a half. And then I had a nightmare one night and went to the internet and discovered, wait a minute, Fukushima is like not taken care of. There's actually nuclear meltdowns, like they're not being buried. And in fact, to this day, Fukushima is in far worse condition than it was. If people can believe this, 3/11/2016 is going to be 5 years when the world has been ignoring four full-core nuclear meltdowns and nuclear melt-throughs that are in a state of China syndrome, which is a state of fission, pouring nuclear pollution into the air, into the food, into the Pacific. We now have seals and whales dying, and they're trying to shove it down our throats that it's just caused by La Nina. Just as in St. Louis, they're trying to tell you that, you know, a lot of the cancers, the problems that you guys have in St. Louis is not caused by the nuclear pollution. You know, so I applaud you for your efforts here, Drew, because your first two goals are going to have to be fighting what I call the 90% rule. I have been, since I found out about Fukushima, studying Dr. John Goffman's work. In fact, on my YouTube channel, Nuts for Art, I painstakingly read two of his books. And I have had several hundred people listen to him. But in his books, Dr. John Goffman was a scientist. He was a biologist, actually. He was asked to study the negative effects of radiation, or not the negative effects, what the government did when he was hired by the Livermore Lawrence Lab up in California, was to find out if nuclear pollution, if this waste product that we're getting, might not be so bad for humans, might actually be pretty good for us. We hear that meme going on today. And that was his first role, to see if we could find any good that could come out of it. And if he couldn't find any good, then their second mandate was to make sure that it didn't cause any harm. And the third thing, obviously, was that it was immediately harmful. And he and Dr. John Goffman and Dr. Linus Pauling, who many of us know as the vitamin C guy, in fact, the vitamin C project that he got involved in sprang out of his research on nuclear pollution, because vitamin C, taking mass quantities of vitamin C, protects us from radiation. But when they came out and unequivocally proved, scientifically proved, that radiation causes harm, they were drummed out of the industry. So John Goffman did his own studies. He was shocked that our government had destroyed the documents on their subjects from Hiroshima and Japan. They destroyed a lot of the documents on women and children. So he went to Japan and conducted his own studies. And he showed that after a 20-year period, he came out in the 60s with an article that said, "The United States government, the nuclear industry, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the AEC, which is the Atomic Energy Commission, now it's called the NRC, and the U.S. military regularly deny that radiation causes harm and underreport the negative effects by 90%. And if there is anything else they can point to that will cause a disease, they exclude looking at radiation as a cause 100% of the time." So we've got, yes, and it's actually, they have stuck with that program and, in fact, expanded it into many other industries. You know, it's the whole, they are sticking with the program on that one. They've used that now in the GMO model, and they've used it in the, there's several areas, you know, the electronics models. I mean, it is very interesting, but this is how deep it goes. This is why when you and I call our elected representatives, they look at us like, well, it's just not that bad. Radiation isn't that bad. It's just not that bad. They are buying the story. Like a perfect example of what we were talking about earlier is in Flint, Michigan. At the hearings, the congressional hearings, Drew, it came out that the regional head of the EPA literally lied to the mayor of Flint, Michigan, and said, "Don't worry, there's no problem with the water," when she knew for a fact there was. And so that mayor went about his business and said, "No problem." So I do want to talk to you, though, a little bit about one of your things, your second goal with Governor Nixon. Tell our listeners about this. There were over what? How many signatures were delivered to his office?
To date, we have a little over 13,000, and that was enough to get us in to at least speak with senior staff. And they assured us that they didn't believe it was a problem because the EPA is, has got it covered. So
here we go. The EPA is telling them it's no problem.
Yeah. With this, we realized that, we need to do more research, and we need to build our base, and we need to understand more what this looks like. So we were assured that that the EPA would come out in December of last year with a plan for an isolation barrier, and we waited for that, and the EPA came out with an announcement that they would, move forward with the isolation barrier when they could confirm a location. Now, in 2014, when the EPA was instructed to build an isolation barrier, they couldn't because they couldn't find a clean line. They couldn't find any soil that wasn't contaminated by this radioactive waste to move forward and begin design and construction. So we understand that that the EPA, while they have for years told us that that the fire poses no risk to the radioactive waste, now they're as far as what they've said, making this a top priority, which seems like they're kind of doubling back on that. Why build a barrier if there's no threat? But again, they couldn't announce it formally. They couldn't release anything to the public. I've taken it upon myself with what I've seen happen in Flint and the diligence and the persistence of the reporters and citizens to uncover this story is to constantly make public document requests and get the information into the hands of the public so the public can make an informed decision when they participate with their government. And we've sunshined soil samples and from on-site and off-site of the landfills from all of 2015, which the DNR has kind of withheld a lot of that.
Okay, so can I stop you a minute here? You use these kind of technical words. What do you mean by you sunshine them?
I'm sorry. That's a Missouri law, so I realize that everyone might not be familiar. It's basically, you can think of like the Freedom of Information Act where you can, it's a public document request.
Okay.
We call it
okay.
The Missouri Sunshine Law. Yeah.
Okay. And the DNR is Department of Natural Resources.
So we've asked for soil samples, water samples.
Yeah. Great. And when will they be getting those to you?
No later than March 8th.
Well, I hope you will come back and share those results with us because is going to be tantamount. It'll be interesting to see what they've studied and what they've looked at. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because
right.
Now, do you trust them to tell the truth, to not jimmy-rig their calculations?
Well, that's a good question. I want to share with you and your listeners this. It's a brief letter, but I feel like this really gets to the heart of that question and this issue, not just in Missouri or Flint Oregon, but I think all around the nation. This letter was written by Dan Norris, a former employee of the Department of Natural Resources. It is an open letter to the people of Missouri, but again, I believe it kind of gets to the heart of this issue and that question. This is dated January 10th of 2015. My name is Dan Norris. I am a former employee of the MDNR, having worked there for 8 years. In the 8 years I spent in Missouri, I have grown to love it far more than I ever imagined I would. The people of Missouri have a diverse mix of backgrounds, the scenery is remarkable, and the rivers and recreational opportunities abound. In my role with the DNR, I worked on a number of issues involving public safety, as well as human and environmental health. My work led me to a unique situation. I directed the air sampling efforts around the Bridgeton Sanitary Landfill for the DNR from 2012 to January of 2014. Along with the help of a number of my colleagues, I developed and implemented the air sampling plans for the Bridgeton community. I built data systems, worked with contractors, created maps, conducted sampling, and coordinated with the landfill owners and property owners in the area surrounding the landfill. During the heavy construction activities of 2013, I lived in the community around Bridgeton. I put up with the odors in the hotel I stayed at and personally experienced what life was like for those who lived or worked around the landfill. I was one of the only DNR staff who lived in the community during this time. I was even there for the tornado that hit the community in 2013. Besides my time living there, I spent a substantial amount of time in the community conducting and overseeing air sampling activities. I had a very good working relationship with a number of people in the community during my work there, and am quite understanding of the different points of view and concerns that citizens in the community had regarding the landfill. Growing up in a family that made a living from the pharmaceutical and petrochemical industries, I am always mindful of our need for industrial goods and services. There are many facets of any issue, and one must be careful to not judge an issue on a single of these factors. Unfortunately, in the balance of factors, political forces appear to dominate above many of the other factors in Missouri. The subsurface oxidation event, subsurface smoldering event, suspect fire, or whatever other name you wish to assign it, has been going on for 4 years now, and it could very well continue on for many years to come, based on the amount of waste at the site and how similar events around the country have progressed. While the landfill owner has spent considerable money and resources to address some of the effects of the event, conditions are still far from ideal. The area involved in the smoldering has increased in size since the start of the event. There is still no solid isolation plan. Groundwater continues to be contaminated, and soil gas migration continues to pose a risk to nearby structures. In 2012, a number of conceptual options were discussed for isolating the event from the radioactive material. One option was a trench. Concerns with this approach included potential impacts this could have on the community, such as odors, nuisance, potential impacts to Lambert International Airport, dust, asbestos, and other pollutants. An alternate isolation strategy was to install a cooling wall or freeze barrier, which might be less impacting on the community. To my knowledge, the landfill owner has only implemented very minimal cooling systems. Instead, owner pushed strongly for installing a trench similar to how the countrywide landfill event in Ohio was handled. This necessitated a radiological material investigation at Westlake Bridge, which identified that radiological materials went beyond the area previously thought to encompass them. Rather than continuing the radiological investigation to find a possible area to install a trench, the investigation was terminated.
What?
If the plan to install a trench does move forward, it is imperative that all of the potential impacts on the community are taken seriously by conducting an appropriate investigation to design removal actions and that proper monitoring is conducted to ensure community safety. Based on my experience, lack of communication is one of the biggest challenges that face those working on the project. There were many instances where DNR staff were not informed by landfill owners of a situation involving the site until seeing it firsthand or being informed by members of the community. Equally challenging was the lack of political appetite within DNR to pursue this case to its fullest. There was also a lack of information sharing among some DNR staff at times. Although the degree to which this event had an impact on the community is unprecedented, there exists an overall cozy relationship between the owner and DNR. For a while in 2012 and 2013, the landfill owner referred to themselves and DNR staff involved with the landfill as, quote, Team Bridgeton. As an example of this relationship, in 2011, the landfill owner pushed for the DNR to release a financial assurance instrument held to address problems at the landfill and requested that DNR change the status of the facility from inactive to closed. In lieu of the closure financial assurance instrument, the landfill owner proposed a corrective action financial assurance instrument in the amount of $690,000. Few people within DNR have the fortitude to stand up pressures of the system, but they successfully did in this instance, and DNR did not approve the release of the financial assurance instrument. Owner has since documented over $100 million in expenses related to remediation and monitoring of the site, far overshadowing the $690 million instrument offered. $690,000. The political problems related to this site were exemplified in 2014 when State Senator Kurt Schaefer offered Amendment 4 to the Missouri Senate Bill 731. This amendment would change some existing state nuisance provisions. Specifically, it attempts to require an owner to live within 1,200 feet of a nuisance to claim damages and attempts to prevent nuisance actions against facilities that are complying with an order issued by Missouri DNR, U.S. EPA, or the Missouri Attorney General's Office. Senator Schaefer is a partner in Lathrop & Gage, a law firm which represents the landfill's owners. I'll leave it to you to judge whether the landfill that this law firm represents stand to benefit from this legislation. Families and workers have been in this community for decades and expect to have a right to live without long-term nuisance impacts. As with most political issues, money seems to drive a lot of what goes on. Missouri Ethics Commission records indicate that Republic Services contributed over $97,000 to Missouri political campaigns in 2014 alone, including $25,000 to the Missouri Senate Campaign Committee, $25,000 to the House Republican Campaign Committee, and $20,000 to the Missouri Democratic State Committee. Missouri Ethics Commission records also show that Lathrop & Gage has made sizable contributions to political campaigns in Missouri. This includes a $10,000 contribution to a campaign associated with Chris Koster and a $5,000 contribution to a campaign associated with Senator Kurt Schaefer's run for Attorney General. In many instances, the potential impacts of the Bridgeton situation have been marginalized by the owner and in some cases have been sensationalized by environmental groups using overblown scare tactics that aren't always supported by science. Meanwhile, the situation has largely been glossed over by state and federal political entities. Public agencies have engaged in a game of bureaucratic finger-pointing, while none have assumed the lead and taken a strong position as a public regulator of the landfill. What is needed in a situation such as this is pure science, unimpeded by money, politics, or mindset. This is what I believe our role at the DNR was supposed to be, and it is what the people of Bridgeton deserve. There is a larger systemic problem with the government, governance in general in Missouri. Rather than asking questions like how a given action will benefit or impact the people of the state, decisions are often made on the basis of how the action will respond to a given legislator, lobbyist, or company that has political pull. So, in many cases, but not all, we are left with a management structure who is dedicated to catering to said political pressures, while there remains an office full of scientific staff who know what should be done in the interest of citizens at large and who are losing their minds because they are fighting their own management structure to simply enforce the laws and regulations that exist and fulfill the very purpose of it. To the news media under the current governor's administration has shifted drastically from when I started working for the DNR. Whereas in the past, technical staff who were experts in what they do and were able to speak directly to the media, DNR employees are now threatened with consequences if they speak to the media, and in some cases to the public. This policy became increasingly restrictive in 2010 and ever more restrictive since. The current Office of Public Information at DNR and the Governor's Office is nothing short of information control. News is constantly spun in a manner to try and make everything look good. While there is a fair amount of good news to report on, many of the aspects that a regulatory agency deals with are simply not that cheery or uplifting. It is an insult to the intellect of the public to try and paint a positive picture out of something that just isn't positive. In many cases, public information just doesn't happen anymore if the news is bad. We should not allow ourselves to live in a society where public officials are impeded the flow of information to the public who they were supposed to represent, yet that is where we find ourselves today. Direction of the current governor's administration. This is the last paragraph, I promise, but this kind of ties it all together. The direction of the current governor's administration and the degree of bureaucracy in state government has left many dedicated employees on both sides of the political spectrum looking for the exit or counting down the days until they are eligible to retire. Part of my decision to leave my position in Missouri with DNR is because of overall disappointment with how we are able to perform our job and anger at the degree to which bureaucracy was consuming day-to-day progress. During my time in Missouri, there have been political pushes resulting in disproportionate power for industry while reducing the rights and power of individual citizens. Politics and fear are, unfortunately, more powerful than science and reason. I wish all Missourians the best in regaining their voice and obtaining a governance structure that represents the diverse interests of the state as a whole, rather than just those with political power. Sincerely, yours, Dan Norris. And that's, I think, that's been a constant source of inspiration for me in our efforts with the Missouri Accountability Project. Those words that's, really hit home and rang as truth, but I want to give you a chance to respond.
That is so breathtaking. I mean, he has spelled out exactly what John Goffman said has happened in the nuclear industry to a T. You know, I have spoken to a woman. I spoke to a woman who worked for the Washington Department of Forestry up there, the Forestry Department up in Washington. And I asked her, what do you think about Fukushima? And she said, let me tell you what, they know exactly that we are being poisoned. They know exactly how dangerous it is. She said, when I worked up here, she goes, you know, you hear about things up at Hanford and the Columbia Generating Station and how things are getting mutated. She said, we saw double-headed deer, double-headed snake, you know, double-headed fish. One time one of her coworkers went to their boss and said, look, we've got to warn people to stop killing the cougars because the cougar population is going down. And, you know, but the cougars were being dramatically badly affected because of the radiation. He was demoted the next day. I mean, he was like, you cannot talk. You cannot say one word about radiation at all. So where are you? Well, you sure sound like you stepped outside. Drew?
I'm sorry. The airport's a constant nuisance. I couldn't hear you there for a second. What was your question?
Are you at the airport?
No. I live right by the airport, though.
Oh, really? So that's the noise that you listen to from the airport. So you really are right there in the heart of this nuclear pollution.
Yes.
Wow. Well, that's a stunning bit of information. Thank you for sharing that letter, because that what that speaks to is to the anxiety and frustration of the people who work for the state who want to do the right thing. So that man retired. Now, is he actively engaged with the Missouri Accountability Project? Have you reached out to him?
We have reached out to him, not as an organization, you know, just to say thanks. That was a very courageous move, I think, on his part, and pretty ballsy. I don't know another word. It was a bold move. It was a bold stance to take. But I think it's that kind of courage that we need to inspire people, engage the systems that that dictate conditions that ultimately affect their lives. And you know, when these systems have been so corrupted with money and special interests that don't represent the general will of the people, then I think it's ultimately our responsibility and our obligation to not just ourselves, but our neighbors and our communities and our country at large to stand up and to ask questions and difficult questions, and to be persistent with those questions and to seek the information that may be withheld that would otherwise affect your decision making. You know, we can't have a democracy if it's uninformed.
That's why they try to impede the flow of information is to impede the flow of
personal freedoms and our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, I'm a self-proclaimed libertarian, so I guess that's where that comes from. But I think that's one of those core principles that defines our nation.
Well, look, I think that nuclear pollution, John Goffman said this in one of his books, you know, we actually ought to sue the nuclear industry with a class action lawsuit because they have stolen our right to the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, not only has the government been co-opted by the nuclear industry and everything nuclear gets a free pass, but our scientists have been co-opted. Our scientists are being told to protect the harm that's being caused by these nuclear technologies. It's a complete outrage. It's, to be honest, it's something that really, honestly, I don't know if you know who Cynthia McKinney is, but she used to be a congresswoman who would not sit down and play the game and, you know, Sig Heil, click her heels and say yes. And she was drummed out of office very rapidly. And she ran for president for the Green Party a few years back. And she speaks very clearly about the fact that our elected officials, the first thing that happens when they get into Washington, D.C., is they are given the little chit-chat. And if they do not comply, they are not going to get reelected. And not only will they not get reelected, they will be ridiculed and demeaned, or worse. So my question is, and this is why I'm on the air, this is why what I work towards, is how do we as citizens get our elected officials to be willing to stand up to this? Because it's like I told my senator, Ron Wyden, they can't kill everybody. They're not going to, if every single person who they have tried to coerce stood up to them, they're not going to kill, like with the, what I call the Unpatriot Act, this is how we got into the conversation. When I found out about Fukushima, I used to call him regularly, and then one day they couldn't talk to me anymore. They're like, well, ma'am, we can't share that information with you. And I'm like, why not? The Fukushima has been deemed a national security event and pushed under the Patriot Act so that now our elected officials cannot discuss anything with us because it's against the law. It's considered national security. And I'm like, that's ridiculous. You have an obligation to warn your constituents of what you know. I mean,
They have an obligation, but I don't. They have an obligation, but I don't think they have an incentive. And I think getting back to your question of how do we get our politicians to stand up, I don't think that we can. I think that our government has been so infiltrated and co-opted by industry that we have to, as a people, recognize the problem, but then begin to elect officials into office that aren't incentivized by industry, and I think that will take major campaign finance reform in this country. And I think that's one of those issues that is such a hot topic with in not just the presidential debates, but locally too. In that, we've become so accustomed, and when I say we, I speak for the general American populace, as divided as it may have become. Accustomed to this idea that the more money that you have, the better chance you have at winning an election, because elections are so controlled by the media, who are controlled by the industries that support and fund the candidates that they put into office. So it's a vicious cycle, and I think the only way we can fix this glitch, that we can debug it, we can debug our system that's become corrupted, is by reforming our campaign finance system.
I
don't give any particular endorsements.
Well, I do.
There are certain candidates that have.
I am an unabashed Bernie Sanders supporter. I think he's the only rational choice in my view. I'll be frank with you. There isn't another
I'll come out of the closet. I'm feeling the burn too, but.
Well, we don't need to come out of the closet. As Americans, we have an obligation and a right to say, you know what, he's the only candidate that has stood up in debates and said, any Supreme Court justice that I put on there is going to want to turn over Citizens United. That's a hallmark for him. He has made that statement. Yeah. And frankly, I tell this to my Republican friends who tell me secretly that, well, I like Bernie Sanders myself. Well, then you need to re-register as a Democrat and vote in the primary, because who I call Monsanto Clinton, I refuse to call her Hillary Clinton. She sold out, and her name is now Monsanto Clinton, has completely sold out, and she has no qualms about stealing elections and primaries, as we have seen in the Iowa caucus.
Bernie is not just up against industry, he's up against the Democratic establishment. I think that was definitely...
He's up against everything. I mean, both sides, not just the Republicans don't want Bernie Sanders, the Democrats don't want Bernie Sanders. Let me tell you what.
Well, I think he has the... I think he has the will of the people behind him, so that's encouraging.
Yes, he does, but we do need people to register to vote as a Democrat. And then go back, once Bernie becomes the nominee, go back and re-register. Like, I was a registered Green Party member, and as soon as Bernie jumped in the vote, I'm like, oh, yeah, and I re-registered as a Democrat. I held my nose and re-registered as a Democrat so that I can vote in the primary, because if you are not a registered Democrat, there's only very few states where independents or unaffiliateds can vote in the you can vote in the general, but not the primary. So we need overwhelming numbers. And frankly, it's part of the issue. And Bernie is also the only person that has talked about ending the nuclear industry and taking a serious look at how we have been running the nuclear lies and the nuclear pollution. I'm going to tell you what. The status quo is going to kill our country. We cannot afford it. And it is killing our country. Look what's happening in your in your town right there. I mean, so we have just a few minutes left here, Drew, on this hour that we're interviewing. And I want to ask you, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you some personal questions. Have you, you've lived there all your life. Have any of your family members had leukemia, cancer, diabetes, autism, had any sort of negative effects from the radiation that you guys have had to live in?
Fortunately, no.
Thank God for that.
But, you know, I have, many friends, and family friends that have been impacted. So
really? So you do know people in your neighborhood who have been impacted?
Yeah.
Wow, that's really sad. Well, this is the thing that really compels me to keep talking about this issue in St. Louis because that's the first thing. The one thing that we can do, I guess, is ask our listeners to please call Governor Jay Nixon's office, correct? And ask him to declare a state of emergency. Do you happen to have his phone number handy?
I do, and I would also like to note that our website, MissouriAccountabilityProject.org, which is live now. We're going to wait to launch until next week on social media because we're still working on our information archive. But you can find all the contact information for Governor Jay Nixon, our senators, our representatives, and our state senate and St. Louis County Council at MissouriAccountabilityProject.org/contact. The number for Governor Nixon's office in Jefferson City is 573-751-3222.
That is awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
But is there anything else that we haven't covered that you'd like to briefly cover? We have about nine minutes left for the hour.
One last thing. I just want to give us my sincerest thanks to everyone who has brought this issue to light and who has built positive media relations and who has reached out to their community, has reached out to their neighbors sympathetically and even brashly sometimes. You know, sometimes it just takes... sometimes it takes an effort to drive past the cognitive dissonance to really get people to understand what's happening and bring their heads out of the sand. So I want to give a thanks to Just Moms STL and everyone there. You can find them on Facebook and at STLRadWasteLegacy.com. And I want to give a thanks to our state senators who helped to pass Senate 2306. For the transfer, and for everyone else that has supported and involved with the Missouri Accountability Project and helped get that off the ground, you all have done fantastic work. And you know, it's gonna be a long haul. There are no quick fixes, but thank you. And lastly, the nuclear industry may be short lived. Hopefully, but at the same time, nuclear waste is something that we're going to have to deal with for generations, thousands upon thousands of years. So I wouldn't let it discourage or dishearten you, just know that this is a problem that isn't going away. And for me personally, and hopefully I get to grow old and have wrinkles under my eyes, and you know, talk to my grandkids and great grandkids about you know, the epicenter of nuclear waste and what I was able to do, at least in small fashion, to affect some change, and hopefully inspire them to have a voice and speak for the environment, for public health and safety, so that they may grow old and tell their grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And I want to thank you also for providing a voice to activists and to community organizers and everyday people who are not only aware of this issue but feel some obligation to take some action on it. So thank you, Lonnie.
Well, you're welcome. I mean, it is my honor. You know, to be honest, I personally feel that as Americans, this is all of our duties to really stand up to this. And you are absolutely right. We do all need to take action. You know, this is not a quick fix. And it reminded me of an article that I read on my YouTube channel. I started in this venue coming at it through YouTube. I have a YouTube channel called Nuts for Art, NutzForArt. I've read John Goffman's book. I actually read a document that was given by Dr. Alvin Weinberg. He was a pro-nuclear proponent. This speech that he gave was in 1972, November of 1972, to the science writing of the briefing in New Horizons. And it was released. This is how time sensitive it was. It was released by the government on 10/25/2006. But in this, he basically said, this is a really interesting thing. Now, it's at the very long end of his speech, and he's talking about the waste disposal. Now, this is a pro-nuclear proponent. He says, plutonium-239 has a half-life of 24,400 years, and waste containing this nuclide will remain potentially dangerous for 200,000 years. Moving on down through the article, it says plutonium-239 requires a long-term commitment by highly intelligent managers of such waste systems. Thus, the price exacted by permanent disposal of waste in concrete vaults may be a commitment to a priesthood that will tend the value for these times for unimaginably longer than any time scale of any previous endeavor. So the interesting thing about this is the nuclear industry, they consider themselves to be the nuclear priesthood. And I think the fact that they consider themselves to be above the law, the Price-Anderson Act puts the nuclear industry above the law, that this attitude and lack of connection to the rest of humanity allows them to draw a wall, an invisible wall between us and them, the haves and the have-nots. And we're obviously the rest of us. Like I say on the introduction to my radio show, they consider us to be assets on a balance sheet. And that in itself is the attitude that must change. And the only way that we can change that is for us to accept our response. It's our responsibility and our honor. Like, this is my honor to help you. I really believe that this is our duty here. We're on this planet, all of us together. It's a small planet. A handful of people have made these big decisions for billions of people and for billions of animals. I know here in Oregon, we have had a whale and dolphins wash up on the West Coast in the last week, and it's been a major heartbreak. And true to form, not one word about nuclear radiation or pollution from Fukushima is ever discussed. They're blaming it on La Nina, on the planet warming. But, you know, when you're pouring, when you have four nuclear meltdowns in Fukushima that are nuclear volcanoes, pouring out the most highly radioactive and hot material on the planet for 5 years straight, it has to affect the food supply inside the Pacific Ocean. And we are now beginning to watch animals. And we, our elected officials need to wise up, because soon there will not be food on this planet, enough food to sustain human life. So and actually, you know, didn't the CEO of Nestle say that water is not a human right? I mean, honestly. So we
that would take another hour to discuss.
Well, I'll invite you back for that other hour, actually, to be honest, okay. Because we really do need to have more time. I hope you will come back, because letter that you read to us, came from the Missouri Natural Resources, an ex-employee of the Missouri Natural Resources, correct?
Yes, you can search Dan Norris, D-A-N-N-O-R-R-I-S, open letter, and you should pretty easily be able to find it.
Wow. Do you know what happened to Dan Norris?
Dan Norris is taking his time off, to my knowledge. I'm not sure what he's doing now, but I imagine.
Do you know if he's gotten involved with the Moms of St. Louis or anything, or you guys just don't hear from him anymore?
Yeah, I mean, he has reached out and contacted them, and, you know, I can't speak direct. I just know that he has reached out.
Okay.
But I'll follow up with them, and I'll get back to you, and hopefully maybe we can talk about that next time.
Well, I think I'm going to search him out. I sure would love to have an interview with him, because he seems to know a lot about how it all, from what I can see. And I wonder if he would be willing to go public and be on the radio about it, because, you know, he wrote a public letter, but that's quite a different thing than being interviewed on the radio. Even though UCY.TV, that's where this radio show will be podcast and broadcasted from for the listeners of UCY.TV. It's the Age of Fission radio show. And this is a venue on Blog Talk Radio that potentially has 50,000 listeners. So we may be live, and hopefully there are people listening to us right now. We do have public visibility. I have to say, this is my very first live interview that I've done on air. So thank you for joining me. So is there anything
thank
else?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners before we end?
I would like to share with your listeners, as I believe I did last time, to stand up and speak out. And again, just ask the difficult questions and be persistent and vigilant and follow through with due diligence. And you know, that's what it takes to hold each other and our elected representatives accountable. So thank you again for listening. And thank you, Lonnie, for having me.
Well, thank you, Drew. That's Drew Kuhn with the Missouri Accountability Project, which you can find at the MissouriAccountabilityProject.org. And my name is Lonnie Clark. You've been listening to the Age of Fission radio show. Put your courage feet on. Please take action. Do it afraid. And thank you for joining us, and we will talk with you soon.